Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast on why bother diagnosing celiac disease. My name is Sam Robinson. I'm a GP and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. Today I will be talking to Professor David Sanders. David is a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Sheffield, a consultant at the Royal Hallamshire Hospital and the NHS England National Centre for Refractory Celiac Disease. He is the current chair of the Celiac UK Health Advisory Council, board member of the European Society for the Study of Celiac Disease, and the former president of the International Society for the Study of Celiac Disease. Hi, David, and thank you for your time today.
Hello, and thank you for that introduction.
Right, so we've decided to go with quite a provocative title for our podcast today, which we'll discuss a little later. But my first question is this. As GPs, we feel we're familiar with celiac disease, but there seems to be a large number of people undiagnosed. Why do you think this is?
So I think that the most important thing is that the very nature of celiac disease has changed over many years. And currently, 1 in 100 people have got celiac disease. But in the United Kingdom, for every case that we recognise, there are probably 2 that we don't. So if you put that into the perspective of being a GP, a family doctor, then you can imagine if you look at the number of patients that you see every day, there must be cases of celiac disease sliding past you. And I think what you've asked is very relevant. And the key issue here is that this is a subtle disease. Not only has it become far more common, you know, in the 1950s, the BMJ, Sam said that basically 1 in 8,000 people had celiac disease, and that it was a diagnosis of babies, toddlers, failure to thrive, certain classical features. And this has kind of gone into the psyche of medics in our textbooks and from our medical school student teaching days, but it's just not what the case is now. Now it can present in so many different ways and frequently with very subtle symptoms. So I think that is why we are failing to recognize this condition. It's really a paradigm shift in our understanding.
That's really interesting. I think, you know, you're right. Many of us would think of celiac disease if a patient presented with diarrhea or abdominal pain, but when else should we be testing for celiac disease and what should we be advising?
So I would like to make a suggestion that you kind of think of the gut as just an entrance point. Whoever that person is that eats gluten, and for whatever reason, it's an autoimmune disease, you know, and their immune system responds in a negative way and they develop inflammation in the small bowel, the antibodies that we test for, and so on. So yes, you're right. You can present with those very significant symptoms, but you could present with any kind of gastrointestinal symptom. It might just be some bloating or a little bit of dyspepsia or heartburn. So that's one category, presenting with any non-specific gut symptoms. Then if you imagine that the small bowel is home to where all the nutrients are absorbed, all the deficiencies that you may see in your practice, low ferritin, iron deficiency anemia, low vitamin B12, low vitamin D, low folate, again, these may be subtle markers of malabsorption, and that might well be linked into celiac disease. So that should have a second trigger point in your mind. I've mentioned that it's an autoimmune disease. So if you've got other people with autoimmune diseases, autoimmune thyroid disease, type 1 diabetes and so on, then you'll find a very high associated prevalence of celiac disease. If you and I went to a type 1 diabetes clinic right now and tested 100 people, something like 5 to 8 of them will have unrecognized celiac disease. And of course, if they are having difficulties with their medication or gastrointestinal symptoms or hematinic deficiencies, then you're building a picture up. You will have probably heard and read of neurological complications presenting with ataxia or neuropathies. And that's really because your autoantibody response is varied. We have the antibodies that we use for diagnosis, and that's tissue transglutaminase 2. But TTG6 is found in the brain, in deposits in people with celiac disease and ataxia. And then, of course, I'm sure you're familiar with and have heard of dermatitis herpetiformis, which effectively is celiac disease presenting in the skin. And the tissue transglutaminase for that is TTG3. So it's a different TTG. So I don't know why one person presents in one way and another in a different way, whether it's you have that immune response to gluten and then it's how you yourself personally respond that determines what you present with. But if you have that constellation in your head, think of the gut as the entrance point. And of course, the final thing that people often forget to ask about is family history. If you have got celiac disease, then all your first degree relatives have a level of a risk of somewhere around 10%. So 1 in 10 chance, again, coming back to the fact that 1 in 100 of the general population have got celiac disease. So if you see it in the way I do like that, then you kind of have triggers in your mind. If you were seeing a patient tomorrow in your clinic and they said they had a bit of IBS, well, then that's them already kind of one flag up. If you then happen to notice that their folate's a bit low, you'd think, actually, it's probably quite a high chance of having unrecognized celiac disease. Does that feel like a natural way to understand it and a construct that helps?
Yeah, definitely. I hadn't realized there was such wide-ranging effects of celiac disease. I think we're so focused sometimes on the abdominal things that actually it's a really good approach to think about that being just an entrance point and having all the different presentations that could follow on from that. Is there anything when we're testing people that we need to talk to them about? Or is there any nice guidelines or other guidance that we should be looking at?
Absolutely. So NICE guidelines are very clear about the opportunities of when you should consider testing. And really what we've already talked about, Sam, fulfills all the NICE criteria. A simple thing like IBS type symptoms, you should absolutely, it's mandatory now to test for celiac disease. I think one of the things that I would say to you is that sometimes we change our practice going forward. So if I come and present to you and say I've got IBS type symptoms, you think, yes, NICE guidelines recommend testing for that, as they do for iron deficiency anemia or family history or so on, and I will do it. But if I come to you and you look through my notes and it mentions that I had IBS back in the midst of time 5 years ago, you may not think to test at that moment. So I think it's always worth applying that kind of broad medicine and looking at all the problems of your patient, and then that will lower your threshold for testing. And I think you're more likely to recognize patients. Coming back to the actual logistics of it, there are a couple of crucial things. The first is to make sure that your patient hasn't already reduced gluten, which people do. First of all, there's a whole world out there of views about gluten that we're not going to discuss today, but are not always the correct perspective. And I think really crucially, we have to say, hang on, are you eating gluten? And what does that mean? You know, is this the equivalent of 4 slices of bread? A slice of bread is about 2.5 grams of gluten, so about 10 grams of gluten a day. Currently in society, most of us eat about 10 to 15 grams of gluten. So it's not inconceivable for a patient with symptoms to have sort of worked out that maybe gluten is driving it. So that's the first thing, what's happening with the patient, because the test will be affected. Then you also have to counsel them not to make any changes afterwards if you then tell them they've got positive antibody results when they're waiting for their camera test or whatever. For the blood tests, they're really good. The antibodies are fantastic. Tissue transglutaminase antibody and endomycial antibody have a positive predictive value in excess of 90%. So compared to most other serological tests that we use for other disease groups, they're fantastic. But we then want to go on and confirm by doing a gastroscopy and taking a biopsy and demonstrating villous atrophy on that biopsy. So you have a cast iron diagnosis, positive antibody, and villous atrophy and biopsy, and that really makes sure that you've clarified the diagnosis for the patient. I think that's also very important going forward, because a gluten-free diet for somebody with celiac disease is likely to be for life.
Great, yeah, that's really helpful. And I think certainly that will change my practice involving the different presentations and what to talk about with patients when we're discussing testing. Now, back to our podcast title, and I'm going to play devil's advocate a bit here. Having spoken to colleagues, most GPs feel they have quite a low threshold for recognising potential celiac disease and therefore requesting a blood test, but then seem to get very few positive results. So it begs the question, why should we bother testing for celiac disease?
If I reflect that back on you as a medic like me, here we have a disease where two-thirds of the cases are unrecognised. And in primary care, I think about, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think about 15% of consultations or more are related to gastrointestinal symptoms, just to gastrointestinal symptoms alone. We're not throwing in anemia or any of the other things that we've been discussing. So I think we have a duty of care if a condition is under-recognised to test for it. If the tests are negative, that's fine. But if you're missing cases, and one of the interesting things that we see in patients with celiac disease is that they'll often tell you that they had symptoms for some time before the diagnosis. So work done by Celiac UK, the national patient charity, suggested that patients had symptoms on average going between 5 to 13 years prior to being recognized. So they keep being seen for different things. You know, they turn up, maybe they've got a little bit of bloating, but they're told they have IBS. Then a couple of years down the line, they come in with reduced bone mineral density, they're given vitamin D and calcium. Then another few years goes by and something else happens, perhaps it's subfertility or something, but no one puts the whole package together. So I think that having a low threshold for testing is good. The tests are cheap and it may be life-changing for the individuals which you recognize. There have been a couple of historical primary care-based studies, one which I ran and one which occurred in Oxford, where literally you created a hit list, not really from NICE's current hit list of groups of symptoms or signs for which you should test. And when this was undertaken by GPs in Oxford and here in Sheffield too, we considerably increased our diagnostic yield. So I think that that's a very valuable approach. I'm not put off by having a negative test. That allows me to exclude that in the diagnostic pathway. And that's good for the patient too. And it's not, it really is a very reasonably priced test. I think the second thing to say is, at the end of the day, I feel we have an obligation to try, if someone comes to you with symptoms, we have an obligation to try and find out why, perhaps rule out their different problems or try and make a diagnosis of a particular disease. What happens to the patient thereafter is their choice. You know, if you are an elderly person, so a really good example of this, which again, we've done work here in Sheffield with, is we've looked at patients who come through the two-week cancer path, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. And the typical story will be iron deficiency anemia, please exclude cancer. And of course, they'll have a normal colonoscopy, they'll have a gastroscopy, they'll have a biopsy, and they'll come back saying celiac disease. And then you and I will say, oh my gosh, this person is 76, and we've just made a diagnosis of celiac disease. Really? Are we really seriously going to now put them through this life-changing event that everything they eat, now they have to be considering gluten-free diet, the economic impact of that, the quality of life, all of these issues. And I totally feel like you, that this is something that is about informed decision-making. I think it's important to make the diagnosis, but we then are in a situation where we can discuss this with the patient, can't we? And we can say to them, here's what we found, what would you like to do? And I think that there are two reasons to change your diet. One is to feel better. So if I'm a patient and I've got lots of symptoms and I've come and presented you with these symptoms and you've found that I have celiac disease, maybe I'll want to make a change, feel better, alter my diet and so on. And then you might say, well, what about the complications, the risks, the long-term risk of reduced bone mineral density, the inflammation in your gut that has a higher risk, therefore, of gastrointestinal cancers and so on, persisting hematinic deficiencies? Well, It might be if I've come through that cancer path that I'll say, look, I'm fine. And I've always been fine. And yes, I was feeling tired and I am anemic. And I'll be fine with some iron tablets. And that's what I would like to do, doc, if you don't mind. That's what my choice. But at least we are not being paternal. We are helping that patient make an informed decision. And at the back of your mind, you always have to remember that we are pre-pandemic, we are an ever-aging and fit aging society. So 76, you know, hey, it's the new 30, isn't it? So you don't know what the patient's going to tell you. And certainly I've my impression is that some patients will still want a gluten-free diet, and it's almost like a 50-50 split, but that's anecdotal.
That's really interesting. I think you're right. Someone who's 76 could have a good 20 or so years left. And if that means they could be symptom free, then that may be a choice they want to make. So I've read a couple of papers that I think you've been involved with, comparing quality of life studies in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, and also talking about secondary care inertia. And I just wondered if you could kind of elaborate on those a little bit more.
So it's an interesting disease because, you see, it's just a diet. That two words, just, or three words, just a diet. And I have watched how that plays out in secondary care, which is that there's a kind of perspective that celiac disease isn't really such a big deal, either for the clinician or the patient. And I find that a fascinating perspective and transaction. And I remain convinced that if there was a tablet or a medication for celiac disease, as there is for type 1 diabetes or autoimmune hypothyroidism or so on, that this would never be given such, dare I say, dismissive approach, which is, oh, here you've got a diagnosis, off you go, try a gluten-free diet, no need to have anything thereafter, it's not a big deal. And I think that is an error. And I think that when you look at quality of life for patients with celiac disease, it is or can be significantly reduced before the diagnosis. But even thereafter, it's quite tough for them because most of us love the food we eat. Most of us eat food three times a day. And those transactions for individuals with celiac disease is a problem on a daily basis. And if I make sense of that, here I am doing an interview with you. Let's just say I have ulcerative colitis. I don't need to tell you anything. I can take my medication, be in remission, come and meet you. When we're having lunch, we can just chat. Then we can do the podcast. You don't know anything about me, and we're fine. But if I have celiac disease, I have to come and say to you, hang on, Sam, what's that? What food is there? Is it gluten-free? Declare myself, suddenly I've got a disease, I'm different to you now. I feel embarrassed and a bit socially awkward about the whole thing. So those daily transactions for people are complicated. And then it's overlaid further by the fact that society has sort of grabbed gluten and made it into a whole different world. So for some people, the minute you say you've got celiac disease, they may not even understand that that's a disease and think that you have a fad or that you are really kind of complicating your dietary choices. So I think it's tough for people with celiac disease on a daily basis. Of course, there are many diseases you can have that are far worse, but the day-to-day transaction for them is real, and the day-to-day lived experiences of people with celiac disease and the problems that they face from how they are viewed by society, the medical fraternity and so on, is also real and published on and well documented. So I think that there's really work to be done there to try and change how we see this and to help empower these patients so that they get a slightly better deal than they have done to date, really.
Well, thank you for that. It's really helpful to think of celiac disease in terms of inflammatory bowel disease, and has given me a greater respect for what they have to go through on a daily basis. Finally, what I wanted to ask you about was your thoughts on the future. in diagnosis and management of celiac disease? Do you think there'll be any big changes?
So one of the major things that's occurred as a result of the pandemic is what's being called a no biopsy approach. And I completely understand this perspective and have been, you know, absolutely central to this, which is that we suddenly found ourselves in a situation where gastroscopy is an aerosol generating procedure, therefore higher risk of COVID and so on. And we recognize that for the tissue transglutaminase antibody, which is a quantitative antibody, that if your level as a patient was 10 times the limit of normal, then there was a greater than 90% likelihood that if we did the camera test and biopsy, that you would have villous atrophy. So the conclusion of that work that we published, which was a multi-center international study published in Gut last year, was that actually perhaps you don't need a biopsy for everyone. And that for those individuals who've got a tenfold elevated TTG, you could view them as having celiac disease and start them on a gluten-free diet. Now, that's had some degree of acceleration and traction because of the pandemic. If we look at the data that is available and think how many patients would fall into that category, it might be something like 25%. And that sounds great, but the worrying thing is about what may happen in what I would call the law of unforeseen consequences. So if I take you on a journey of celiac disease, Sam, which is that I used to make a joke and say that, you know, from the perspective of gastroenterologists and secondary care, that people would say, well, I'll make the diagnosis, there you go, then off you go for your diet, and then I'm discharging you, and I don't want to be involved anymore. And so that was evidence, if you wish, of inertia or nihilism towards this condition. So that was a joke of 10 years ago. But what's happened since is, of course, now we've removed the gluten-free prescription, which would never have happened if it had been a tablet, would it? You would never have said, oh, no, I think you should pay. I know type 1 diabetes should get their treatment for free, and I know that we should be giving thyroxine, but I think that celiac disease should pay for their tablets. I don't think that would have happened, but it has happened for a diet. And effectively, the prescriptions are no longer really being used. Then, with this approach of a tenfold TTG, suddenly you don't need a biopsy anymore either. So it may be that you don't even face secondary care. And the risk of this is that in primary care, that message will become diluted. And suddenly anybody with a positive TTG will be simply trialed on a gluten-free diet. So the 21st century joke or the 2020 joke would be no diagnosis, no diet, and no discharge because I'll never see you in the first place. It will literally be, oh, you've got a slightly elevated TTG, give the gluten-free diet a whirl, and if it works for you, fantastic, and if it doesn't, don't come back and see me again. You know, we don't know what will happen with this interim recommendation. I could see that it may well become a real guideline, but we may not be able to control how it's interpreted thereafter in primary and secondary care. And so I do fear for the patients out there, and I also anticipate seeing in the future people who will be coming referred saying, this person was given a presumptive diagnosis of celiac disease, they had a TTG, which in brackets didn't turn out to be greater than tenfold, close brackets, but now they don't know. And we'll be taking these people back through a path and having to do gluten challenges and all sorts of things. I don't want to be doom and gloom, but you can see that there is an inherent risk to this new recommendation. So I think everything has to be handled very carefully. One of the key elements of that recommendation is that they should still be referred to secondary care, but I am not sure that's truly going to happen. So watch this space, I think.
Absolutely. That's great and really interesting, I think, on the potential consequences and the impact to the patients if that does happen. Thank you so much for your time today, David. It's been a really enlightening discussion. Thank you for listening to the RCGP podcast on why bother diagnosing celiac disease.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.